Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Be the Right Club Today podcast. Our next guest is Mr. Frank Navolo. Frank has 15 worldwide wins, including top 10 in all four majors. He is also probably the best commentator in golf that we have today. Frank, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot. But I'd sort of right now, I think I'd take Hell's 15 PGA Tour wins, to be honest, a major, a couple of players, things like that. That'd be what I'd swap for.
Well, Frank, I don't want your job as a commentator right now.
So I figured you're going to say it.
You're fantastic at it. You just finished up the PGA. Tell us about that, what went on up there, and how the week went.
I think Mother Nature, hell, really determined how the event was going to go. I remember playing in 94 at Southern Hills. I think you did too. So the golf course, to be honest, when I first went around, I couldn't recognize a single hole. I really didn't. You know, Hans and Jim Wagner have done a great job. But the hot, balmy conditions that we had the first 2 days, also with the lopsided draw, to be fair, Justin Thomas probably played 2 to 3 shots better than anybody else those first 2 rounds. But then when the weather flipped in the afternoon and Zalatoris took the lead, it looked like it was going to be one of those championships where, c'est la vie, you're on the wrong side of the draw, that's it. Then looking even at the leaderboard on Saturday, it was one of those ones where if you're not inside the ropes, so to speak, you probably wouldn't tune in because there's a lot of names that people really didn't think were household names or names that they could recognize. But it added to a totally different flavor. There's lots of major championships like that you know, we've played in over the years. So it had a different flavor. I really did feel bad for Mito. I thought he hung up extremely well on Saturday. And then he got off to a pretty good start on Sunday. And if that birdie putt on 17 goes, and I was on Jim Rome's show the other day, and he had a thousand different ways he could have played 18 and probably make 5 and win. But it's, Mother Nature kicks in at the start, and then the golfing gods said, no, it's not going to be you today. But I still thought it was a great championship.
I think it was fun to watch, actually. And, hats off to Justin and Bones. Justin played great, and he hit, you know, he played smart on 17 on the first playoff hole. He laid it up, hit a good iron shot in there, and made his birdie. And he actually probably won the tournament when he hit the 3-wood on the green the next. I mean, that kept put all the pressure on Will, and he just played great, I thought. So
yeah, I'm glad you brought up his tee shot on 17 in the second playoff hole, because I think that's the defining shot that I'll probably remember in years to come from that PGA Championship.
Yeah, he was he hit it exactly like he wanted to. He stared it down to the end. You could just tell it had a good feeling the whole time the ball was in the air. You know, as a person watching on TV, you can't see that ball. And I don't know where it's going to end up, but I could tell by the way he was looking at it, he thought it was really good.
Chase, it lacked one thing, though. It lacked Justin Thomas saying, be the right club today.
So Frank, I have to ask this question. What was it like not having the defending champion there?
It was rough. I don't know if I feel sympathetic to Phil. That's probably the best way to put it. Because, you know, I've got to know him since the late 80s, early 90s, you know, when he first sort of cracked out on tour. I think Nick Faldo put it extremely well, where, you know, when you start a career off and you win a PGA tournament as an amateur, I think it was 1990, and then you cap it off by being the oldest major championship of all time, you know, hell, better than anybody. This tournament or this career, this professional golf, is about competition. And Phil earned that right to compete. But, you know, he's looking at something else, you know, which has got dollar signs on it, perhaps. Maybe it's the book. I actually do have a copy here. I haven't read it, but it just delivered this week. So I'm curious to know. I hear all the rumors like everybody else. I'm not certainly going to just give them more credence because I don't know what to be true. And that's, I think, the weirdest thing about these last 6 months. All we do, all we are is just basically recycling rumors. So to get back to your question, yeah, Phil earned the right to play. And I think in years to come, when it all comes out, I'd like to think that that would be one of the biggest regrets of his career. It's a bit like Tiger Woods. I remember Tiger winning his 15th major in 2019, and we had COVID, and I sit at Amen Corner there. And normally when you get off the 11th green and you walk back to the 12th tee, there's a special ovation. And it would have been even more grand in 2020 when Tiger Woods was coming up that hill. But because of COVID, he was denied that. And 2022, Phil, for his own reason, did not get that ceremonial walk as a reigning PGA champion and also the oldest major champion in the history of the game.
So you mentioned Tiger there. I've had three joint replacements. I know what it's like to deal with pain. Walking uphill and downhill is both difficult, and I can see, even on TV, it's hard for Tiger to do that too. I can tell that he's in pain doing that. You think he's ever going to be able to get back?
Well, it's a bit like Bryson DeChambeau. We're all expected him to break down to some degree, even though he's much younger. So if you keep doing what you're doing, you in this game is as much about finesse and touch. So circling back to Tiger Woods, the ankle and the Achilles injuries, the left knee being done 3-4 times, the right knee being done, then the back, and then now the car accident. I think in a weird way, he wants to do his own Hogan-type comeback. The fact that he could, in that condition, make cuts in both majors at the start of this year, when you consider some of the players that haven't, that alone, I think, has been a great achievement. I remember turning on to watch The Father and Son. I don't know if you did at the end of last year.
I did.
Yeah, because I just thought, he's not going to compete. It's just going to be great to see him out there with Charlie. And I think that was the reason why he played. But I got riveted just watching on Sunday when they actually had a chance to win against the Daleys. And you could see, and I think this is the biggest thing that would probably answer your question. You get it more than anyone else. All of a sudden, the look was still in his eyes. That's what I noticed on TV. So if that look's still there, he's going to try and find a way. And he'll probably keep trying to find a way until he can't walk. And I think on one hand, that's incredible. That's why we play this game. We play to compete until you can't play anymore. I know back injuries and took me out. I know you've had similar issues. So when you can't do it anymore, that's when you're forced to stop. At the moment, Tiger's just still trying to find a way to get it done. And I think that's a lesson to everybody.
You too.
Frank, there was a lot that was said about Mito's decision on 18, hitting driver. Faldo was very critical of those guys, really of him pulling out driver. Do you have any opinions on that, three wood versus driver there in that situation?
No, I actually don't mind driver, to be honest. I got Nick's point of view. Nick was saying, and he's won six of these. He was just saying that, put yourself in position. It's the hardest hole on the golf course, and it was long, and he'd actually hit driver down there every day. I just still go back to 17. I think 17, he hit a beautiful cut driver that was probably an inch or two from getting on the putting surface, and it's a relatively simple two-putt. And it does, rather than go up, it rolls all the way down the hill, left him with an awkward chip, leaves it on the edge. And I think originally when he got on the tee, and I haven't spoken to him, so that's why I'm sort of speculating here, he wanted to hit the same shot on 18. But in any sport or anything in life, when you try and avoid something, that's what you're focused on. So you could see it's almost like whatever you do, don't go right. So sort of aiming left. And then I thought Faldo nailed it on the follow through. I mean, there was no follow through. The club barely got above his left hip. So in the end, whatever that last thought was, don't go right. That's exactly where that ball was heading. But it was, it's tough pill to swallow. A lot of people have already compared it to John Vandeveld. It's totally different. He was trying to win the tournament. He didn't have a three-shot lead. Vandeveld got lucky on his tee shot, finished on the 17th fairway at Carnoustie and still found a way to lose it. Mito was one foul swing at the wrong time. So, that's what we do, right? We criticize decisions. But whether he hit three-wood or driver, he made his worst swing on the 72nd hole and paid a pretty severe price.
Well, he will remember that for a long time, but hopefully he can put that behind him. And he made his putting stroke look great to me. And, he looks like a good player. He looks like he's someone that's going to have to be reckoned with down the road.
Yeah, he's confident. We were trying to dip into his bio like you normally do when somebody pops up on the leaderboard like that. You're trying to find out as much as you can. And one question I never really got answered was why he quit when he was about 14 or 15 years of age. He went to Bradenton to the IMG Academy. And when you hear Waco Niemann talk about him, everybody in Chile said, this kid's really good. And Waco looked up to him because he was a little older, but he was apparently extremely good as a mid-teenager. And then he just decided, whether it was a Florida experience or whatever, that golf wasn't for him. And he went away from the game for 2 years. I'm curious why. We never got an answer to that. But then after that, you know, he got back on track. He and Waco Niemann have the same coach in Eduardo McKeel. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. And they have a similar move. They have that sort of dipping move that, you know, is sort of a swing from yesteryear, a guy that I used to play golf with. That was a wonderful striker of the golf ball. As a professional, a guy called Terry Kennell. He sadly passed away. He was a good friend of Mo Norman's. And that was almost the same move. And he could hit it straighter than you could point. But so when you look at Mito, he went to the Corn Ferry Tour. He won three times. He got what we used to call a battlefield promotion. And winning is winning in my book. So he was trying to win. He really was. I hope this is the start of something else. But, you know, Chile's should be very, very happy right now. They have two superb players. One that's used to be the number one amateur in the world, and Waco Niemann, who's already won twice, Greenbrier, as well as Riviera. And you know all about winning at Riviera when you won your PGA championship there. So, you know, and now, you know, Mito, they've got two great players.
Yep, they are two great players and young.
Yeah, young and good. Young and good.
They're going to see a lot more 18th holes, 72nd holes. So let's talk about the LIV. What's your thoughts on all that?
The biggest thing, once again, there's a lot of rumors, Hal. I go back to the fact that when you start playing golf as a teenager, and we just referenced Mito, for example, you play golf to compete. It's your, you know, I came from a small country called New Zealand. It's only, in those days, only 3.5 million people. So, you know, I watched all the best tournaments in the world. Obviously, the PGA Tour was a huge carrot. In those days, you went to Asia. You came from there. Then you went to Europe. And if you were good enough, you finished up in America. Everything was about competition. And to be honest, if you could make a living, that was part of the gravy train. But you played golf because you wanted to win, whatever level it was. I remember winning the New Zealand Amateur. Then it was like, can you do it as a professional? Can you make a cut? Can you win a tournament? You know, how good can you be? To me, the LIV Tour is not about that. It's not about competing. And that's the biggest thing. And no one's explained to me why it is. A lot of the people that are fascinated by it or want to join are obviously, you know, mid to late 40s. So I get it. They want to buy a name and go into it. So to me, they've told me, or what I've read is it's 54 holes. It's a shotgun start. You couldn't get further away from playing in a major championship. So I don't know how it's a viable proposition as an alternative. It's something different in my book.
You said a shotgun start?
Once again, I've seen nothing in writing other than they want to do something that's different. One of the things that I read was, there'll be a shotgun start, so all players will be teeing off one tee. I don't know how you find out who's leading. You know, you tee off the second, I tee off the sixth. You've got the easiest holes to play. I got the hardest. We're tied for the lead. I don't know how you're going to do it. Do you crown a champion on the 12th hole? So the model. Golf's in a weird place. You know, we've had equipment issues. We change our parameters. I got the French Open tennis on the living room at the moment. I love the fact that, you know, they play on one size court, right? Whether it's clay or grass or whatever, NFL, soccer, name the game, hockey. They play on one set of parameters. You know, we, with equipment, we keep tweaking things. But the one thing that still makes golf a great game in my book, two things, actually, the handicap system for the amateurs, but really for the best players in the world, is the ability to compete. And so I keep looking at the best tours. Is the PGA Tour perfect? No, it's not. But it's been a pretty damn good breeding ground for every great player that's played. Going back to the Hogans, the Sneeds, Uhel, you know, when you were voted player of the year, you know, Nicklaus, Floyds, Watsons, even Greg Norman himself, you know, Felder, Curtis Strange. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Now it's Tiger. Now it's, you know, it's Rory, you know, with Bryson DeChambeau. But to be the best of the best was what it was all about. And I just don't see that in their model.
Yeah, I don't think any of those great players, I'm going to step out on a limb here. Money was a byproduct of excellence. It was never about the money. It was about becoming victorious. It was about lifting the trophy. It was about finishing first. And, you know, I never really concerned myself with what first place money was going to be. You know, I was happy to, if I could finish first, that was great. You know, you in golf, you end up being the turtle a lot more than you are the hare. I mean, yeah. You lose way more than you win. And, you know, it feels special when you finally do win.
No question. Hey, I've choked for the money. Don't get me wrong. But you're right. You know, you don't go on the range and or you go to another instructor to try and somehow work out why the ball, why every time I hit a cut, the ball's hanging out to the left. You go there, you get another lesson. You practice till 6 or 7 at night. You're trying to make yourself a better player. You're trying to make yourself a better competitor. You're trying to think better. You're trying to be better than the guy you played against today and tomorrow and on it goes. That search to get better. And the game's always moving forward. Those chains are always moving forward. So you can't afford to do anything other than go back to the range and grind a little harder. And I know they have more tools today in TrackMan and the statistics and that. That's just avenues to try and get these guys to be better. And I love the way they play. I don't necessarily like some of the things the equipment does, but I love the fact that they're trying to figure out the best way to shoot the lowest score. And that part is what has gone through every single generation. You know, we had days in the locker room, you know, where people would say, how'd you play? And you invariably got the answer, well, I hit 12 greens and, you know, I had a bad down the greens. And then the follow-up question, well, what'd you shoot? And whereas nowadays these guys just say, you know, how'd you play? And they go 68. That's it. It doesn't matter how I play. It doesn't matter if it's 6 fairways or 6 greens. It's all about shooting the lowest score and how high up the leaderboard and can you win. And I don't think they should ever change.
So Frank, to that point, why do you think we're seeing so many young players have so much success now, say earlier than they would in you guys's era?
I think equipment is part of that. When I grew up, clubs were heavier. You got hand-me-downs. So if you look at some of the people that played golf, probably 3, 4, 5 years of age when they first started, a lot of them had some ungainly swings because they're lifting very heavy equipment. I think some of those U.S. kids clubs are tremendous for young kids if you're going to play that early. The alternative was you started playing golf a little later when you're strong enough to swing the club. You now have equipment with massive sweet spots, the middle-headed driver, the longer shafts. So these guys, they can get better quicker. You know, golf was more, you were more a surgeon before you were a builder. That's really what it was. You had to learn all the little stuff and fiddle around. You had to think. Whereas nowadays, they've figured the game out there. I know Scott Fawcett, for example, Texas and the Decade system, is they really analyze the game and, you know, distance is paramount, especially with the course setups. If you make a course longer and longer and longer, then you have to hit the ball longer and longer and longer. That's all there is. It's not about, so you're actually giving in to that. And the game is, in my opinion, got a little more sterile because of that. But I purely think equipment. And they were good athletes every era, but these guys are training more specifically for golf. You even see that on the LPGA. With the work ethic, but I really do think it's equipment. Kids clubs are better. The fact that you have a driver that goes straight and out, you have a launch monitor. For example, I would have loved a launch monitor. You know, we were taught to hit down and down and down and down and down. These guys are taught to hit up and up and up. So, you know, sometimes we went down a rabbit hole. It might take you a year to get out of it. I covered an Asia Pacific Amateur Championship. There's a guy on the leaderboard this week called Lucas Herbert, Australian guy. And I was at Royal Melbourne. And I watched him in the practice round, you know, I was just going around and he had like 3 or 4 snap hooks, looked like he was going to have a bad week. And he went to the range and he hit, I think he hit 8 or 9 drivers. That was in front of a track man. He goes, I thought so. And then went and spent the rest of the time in the chip and putting group. Played well that week. So it's the ability to diagnose. I think that's the biggest thing. And also there's actually a bit of a throwback mentality. And I know I'm going on here. There's a bit of a throwback mentality where it's not about pretty swings anymore. It used to be if you were technically a good swinger, or hell, I know when you went to Jimmy Ballard, you know, if you followed a certain model, then that was the way to get better. This is sort of a little bit like Hogan. I know we got his tournament this week. at Colonial. It is about digging out of the ground. If my characteristics of hitting the ball are spot on according to TrackMan or FlightScope, then I play with that. Whether I have a strong grip, a weak grip, doesn't matter what I do. So there's a little bit of a throwback with the new version.
It's interesting. I love your answer about the kids clubs starting out, because we talk about a lot of times you'll see some of the old school swings looking a little bit unique because of not having video or not, there weren't, we didn't talk about, you guys didn't talk about swing plane and draw lines and all the stuff that some of the guys do now. But I also think the fact that they were long and heavy clubs and kids had to figure out how to get it to the top any way they could, where now with US kids, it's so light, they can actually handle the club correctly. That's a great point. I never really thought about that, kind of helping the aesthetics of the golf swing and make you know, kids better earlier, faster. I think that's a great point.
Yeah, if a lot of friends of mine, they play tennis professionals where I live here at Lake Nona. And I asked a similar question actually to them, and I got the same answer. When they learned, for example, with a wooden racket, it was much heavier, their strokes were different. And now these kids, and same thing, they're getting younger, really good tennis players, whether they be male or female. They got lighter equipment and different strings. So there is an analogy there between like tennis and golf. And it's weird, even biomechanically, the way in which they teach tennis players has now become very, very similar to the way in which they teach golfers. So, you know, sometimes you learn by getting out of your own sport, looking at others, and you find you finish up with exactly the same answer.
So Frank, if you were voted head of the USGA, if you were able to initiate change in golf, where would you start?
I would have started limiting the length of the club a long time ago. I was at, they used to have an international dinner at the Augusta when there wasn't as many international players. And I remember sitting down there with members of Augusta National. And this would have been, it was circa 1995. And that was when everybody was trying to reduce loft on a metal wood. It was like 6 degrees. I think Curtis had a 6 degree driver. We had a spinny ball. And we had a similar conversation, like, what would you do? And I said, well, I would draw a line in the sand, like right now. I'd limit loft. The lob wedge was just about to come out. And I think maybe one or two players had it or whatever, but I'd limit loft on both ends. We thought that you're going to finish up with a driver with like 2 degrees. So we were wrong on that. But I thought if you put a limit on the clubs, the length, then even what they could be made out, because we were into graphite, and the graphite in those days wasn't nearly as good as what it is now. But I said, what happens if there's some new ceramic or whatever? You know, let's just limit the materials that you can make it by, limit the length, and therefore we're not going to go out of control. Because what has happened over these last 20 to 25 years is it's ball and driver. They tweak one and then they fine-tune the other. So you get this, you know, leapfrog effect to get more and more out of a club. And more and more out of the ball. And I think that's wrong. All you do then is you just make a course 50 yards longer on each and every hole. So that costs an enormous amount of money. So we've got to stop that. And so to answer your question, hell yeah, I would have limited length a long time ago. I would have limited materials and I would have limited loft. And that's what I would do. I would try to pull some of that back. And consequently, then you have to change the ball. Because if you don't have 60 and 65 degree wedges, you have to put spin back on the ball. And you would do it that way. So they've reduced spin and given you more loft to give you an even easier launch. So basically, they're giving you an automatic car instead of a gear shift.
Well, I'd love to see the ball spin a little bit more, because the game is more exciting when the ball will curve a little more readily, or it'll shoot up into the wind. You know, there was not a more difficult shot in the world than a pitching wedge over water into a 25 mile an hour wind, and you know that.
I can hear it in your voice. Yeah.
We felt it. We've all felt it.
Frank, how do you how would you describe, you're around tour players all the time, and we get asked the question a lot from our listeners, how do you practice? How do tour players practice? What can you help our audience learn from being inside the ropes and watching these guys every week?
Most of them are really a slave to their statistician. Sounds weird when you say a statistician with golf, but there's a lot of players now when they're paying a guy to basically drop a spreadsheet and say, see, you're bad here from 75 to 125. I was picking on Rory then, actually. It's about the one area that needs a lot of work. or, you know, say from 150 to 175. I mean, I'm not a slave to stats because I always think that, you know, they're a way to be right, even if you're not. But they do, they are an indication. So what's really happening now is guys know what's really important. You need to be good inside 10 feet because that's the most putts you get. So, you know, a lot of people when they're putting, you know, we talk about mid-range putters and that, but how many putts do you really make over 10 to 12 feet? You actually don't make very many during the course of four rounds. So it's holing out, it's chipping, it's bunker play. Driving's obviously very, very important. Things like long irons. We used to stand on the range and we would like hit, I don't know, a bag full of two irons. It's a complete not a waste of time now. Because how many two irons do you hit in a round? So their practice is more selective. I'm not saying they spend more or less time than what we did. It's probably about the same amount of time, but they wouldn't be just on the range looking for a better golf swing. Sometimes we did that. Probably, well, I know I did that a little more than I should. And sometimes I practice with clubs that really I didn't use that much that week. So they're a little more, you know, it's more like a race car. You know, what sort of tires do we need for the track and that type of thing. So their practice has become more specific. And also they don't play all the time like we did. You know, sometimes you played either injured or you played with half a game. You learned to score. A lot of these, if these guys aren't ready to play, they pull out. So it's a different approach. They play, you know, they play in high gear. So they train that way. They train, whether it's hit the ball a long way or they train to, you know, be a little more aggressive. And aggressive just doesn't mean hitting it every flag. They're still trying to hit a smart shot, but they're in top gear most of the time. And they don't really like playing golf in any other condition other than top gear.
Do you, with LaPaul, do you think there's too many coaches? Do you think they have too many people on their teams now?
Well, that's a product of money, I think. You know, if I offered you $5 and, you know, if I offered somebody $5 an hour for a job, nobody's going to take it, right? Make that $5,000 and they're bashing the door down. So the PGA Tour's done a great job, and Europe and, you know, anywhere else in the world where prize money's gone like this. I mean, the winner of the PGA Championship last week got $2.7 million. So you can afford to have a masseuse, a coach, a trainer, and whatever. And they're going to tell you how important they are too. So yeah, in some respects, I do answer with your question, but also they're training, as I just said, to be in high gear. So they want all the things that keep them there. You know, whether it's a sports psychologist, because now social media and all that, they're doing a lot of peripheral things that sound and look good. But, you know, to me, just going up to a young kid, giving them a golf ball, looking them in the eye is huge. And you don't see that as much. You see someone run away and tweet and go, hey, what a fantastic golf course. But I'm like, are you really relating to the fans and all that? So a lot of them, are more in a bubble now than ever before. I probably say that from an envious point of view, because I was never allowed this luxury to play what I think is an amazing era for golfers. They make a ton of money. They really do, and they play. Golf courses have never been better. Condition-wise, agronomy's through the roof. You know, you get perfect conditions just about every single week. It's pointless saying a golf course is in good condition, really, because they all are. And, you know, we played in some courses that weren't that good. You know, you had metal spikes, greens were bumpy. But going back to your question, yeah, they've got you could trim some of the state, you know, get rid of a couple of people in your camp. But yeah, it's not unusual for people to have a statistician, a coach, a trainer, and, you know, a psychologist.
An entourage.
Yeah, I didn't want to use that word, but.
Yeah, things have changed, haven't they, Frank?
yeah, hey, it's tough, not always for the better, but also, you know, I try to resist answering as a bitter old twisted golf pro, because I you know, that's what we are to our kids sometimes. So I try and look what I think is better. I do think they play extremely well. I really do. There's no criticism on that. And also they find the best way to deal with this equipment. This equipment gives them an advantage. So they are trying to maximize it. I have no fault with that. But I also think they're good enough to play with, you know, we could reduce the equipment a little bit and they'd still be damn good players. They really would be. And then we wouldn't have to have these, you know, we can have an 8,000 yard long golf course soon. That's ridiculous. And that's going to be the only way. The 16th hole last week, because it was the hole that I was covering, 527 yards, par five for the members. Early on in the week, they're hitting a drive and an 8-iron. I mean, so what about the rest of the clubs in the bag, you know? And you've got to have par threes that are 240, 250 in excess. It was good to see that the players hit clubs other than a wedge all the time, but there is some Dustin Johnson, when he was world number one a few years ago, I think he was like 90% of his shots were 9-iron in, par fours. This is a crazy number. Yeah.
Yeah, that is crazy. Well, I'm glad I don't have to hit a 350-yard drive. I don't ever remember hitting a 350-yard drive.
Al, you would have. Yeah, you used to button it anyway. I mean, it didn't matter what club you hit. Thing. I mean, how many – you probably could count on one hand how many fairways you missed in your career.
Oh. That's a gross exaggeration. I missed plenty of fairways. But
not when I play with you.
So Frank, talking about the 16th hole again at Southern Hills, where you ask the members, they're going to say that's a driver 3-iron, driver 4-iron, driver 3-wood for a lot of those guys. With tour players, it's almost like we're getting to a point where the Dustin Johnson is the LeBron James of basketball, where your average YMCA rec pickup game, those guys can't play at all, and they're comparing themselves to LeBron James, who's so far above and away, so much better than they are. And that's how Dustin Johnson is, and these guys, and Justin Thomas are, and you guys were, compared to the average player. Is bifurcation, whatever the word is it an option? Are we going to have to get to that point? Because if you come teach with us at the academy, we get a lot of guys that they need all the help they can get. Like this game's not getting any easier for them.
I always thought golf was better than any other sport, because we could all play together. And I'm not saying, hey, I dined out in pro-ams every single week, but the beauty of our game is that, you know, and I'm going to go date myself and go back to the wooden driver days, but you would play with the odd amateur that popped it past you every now and again, you know, hopefully not on a regular basis, but, you know, they might hit one that day, or you got on a par three and you're all roughly on the same tees and they hit a shot and it was the closest in the group. Now, you know, in a pro-am, for example, which is still extremely important part of the PGA Tour, you know, the guy goes, hey, see you later. He goes 80 yards further back to the back tee, and he hits a 5-iron. Then eventually he walks about 80 yards back. The amateurs are hitting the same club, nearly. They really are. And so it's becoming more unrelatable. Our game was great because it was one of the few games where we could all sort of hang together, and then the best players would go off from Thursday to Sunday, and they would play for the tournament. But we had a meeting of the minds, so to speak, in the game. And that has been severed with equipment, because this equipment suits better players. It really does. And I had a friend of mine, he's in the hotel business, and he was going to do a drive, you know, like a driver testing. And it was $500 or whatever it is. And I told him not to. I told him to buy a small Mevo, which was a launch monitor. And I said, well, what's that going to do? And I said, well, it's going to save you. It's probably going to save you a couple of thousand dollars. And so what happened? It saved me a couple of thousand dollars. I said, well, if you do a driver fitting tomorrow, they're just going to give you a better driver for the way you swing right now, right? But I said, if you actually get something that tells you that you're way off the mark the way you're swinging right now, you're not getting much, then you'll finish up with a better idea how you've got to hit the ball. So when you get a driver fitting, you'll actually get a better driver for you, which is what the pros do. And I would imagine, I don't know, I put a loose figure on, yeah, best players in the world probably cost them 20 grand, I would imagine, to get a driver that fits them. Because they go, shafts are nearly $1,000 a pop now, the ones that they use. And, you know, they are literally dialing it in. The average amateur, number one, hasn't got the time. He doesn't quite know what he's looking for, even though you guys do a great job trying to fit them. But they're not getting the same benefits that the best players in the world are. It's not apples for apples. So they get a little piece, the professional gets a lot. To me, that's a little back to front. The whole idea of making these game improvement clubs was to give the amateur a big go, right? Give them a little bit of a leg up. Well, it went the other way around, just created a bigger void. It really did. The pros, hey, they get every single thing they want, which they should, don't get me wrong, but they get it's a bigger gap now. Like if you swing the club 116 miles an hour, which is not fast, right? A few amateurs get close to that. The pro will hit it at 300 yards and the average amateur will hit it 260. So hang on a minute, he's swinging the same speed and he's giving up 40 yards. So I didn't initially agree with bifurcation, but if they're going to keep going down this street, sadly, that's where we have to finish up. And that's a shame.
Well, the consumer's paying for all this, you know. I mean, it's cost the consumer an immense amount of money. for this to take place. I mean, it, both in lengthening the home golf courses to stay competitive, and then at the equipment as well.
Yeah, if I buy the house next to me, we have a decent block of land where we are, but it's going to cost me a lot of money, right, just to get another 40 or 50 yards to add to my house. So golf courses are the same. I mean, that's just the basic, you know, fiscal way of looking at it, right? Buy the house next to you and see how much it's going to cost. We're doing that on 18 holes, every golf course.
Yeah.
So members now, it's going to cost members more money to join the club. So therefore, it costs them more to play, costs more for the upkeep. So how is golf cheaper? You know, I know that overused term, grow the game, but so we're going to give you a more expensive game to get into. Clubs are going to be more expensive. The membership's going to be more expensive. It's going to be more. So how are you going to get more people playing that one? I mean, seriously. Yeah, I don't.
Is there any way to make the golf courses harder for, you know, regular tour events? Like I'm thinking of you know, Harbor Town or some of these little short, tight golf courses that can still hold up. I mean, is there anything that they can do?
US this week, Open. Colonial,
great example. Colonial
fits that.
Yeah. My answer would be no. It's just going to frustrate them. That's all. It's like getting a Formula One car and we'll throw a little oil on a couple of corners. Yeah, it's great. They're going to drive slow, but they're going to crash as well. It's like, and it's an admission of guilt, really. It is. If we've got to go to a really small track where they can't fit, basically, so now they're going to hit 2 and 3 irons and 4 irons off a bunch of tees, either that or drive it the bush all day long, then we're basically admitting that the only way we can reduce the scoring is to give them something short and finicky. Because if you give them 7,500 yards and make the greens 12.5, and you know, just you can stick the flags anywhere, you know, and it just sprinkles with rain the night before, they shoot 20 under every single time, unless the wind blows or you go short and dinky and all over the place. I mean, and it's hard because Hilton Head was a great golf course when it was played. Davis Love won around there. He's one of the longest hitters on tour, right? Like half a dozen times. He's hitting 1 irons and he would drive it down. And Colonial was the same thing, but I'm going to go there this week. And there's holes like, you know, the horrible horseshoe, you know, which is 3, 4, 5, right? Well, actually 2 for a start. 2's drivable now, which is crazy. But 3, 4, 5, you really had to golf your ball, right? One hole went right to left and it was, you know, it was a really good driving hole. Now they hit 3 because they ran out of fairway. And then the next hole was top of the tree. It was a piece of timber or your best long iron. And then 5 along Trinity River there, I remember John Mahaffey telling me he played a practice round with Hogan and he pulled out a 1 iron. And Hogan gave him the sponsor's exemption. And Mahaffey's telling me the story when I work with him. And he goes, and Hogan looked at him, grabbed the 1 iron, stuffed it back in the bag and said, son, if you can't hit driver down here, you shouldn't even think of turning pro. And it's a great story, but that would never be applicable today because driver wouldn't be the club, just with the shape of the hole. So it's a shame. It's a shame that these guys don't get to be challenged the way on these great golf courses, the way they used to. And we're going to see the same at St. Andrews this year. This could be the watershed open. They could conceivably drive eight of the par fours, you know, which is just tragic. It's tragic.
Yeah. Catch the right wind, or if the wind doesn't blow at all, they're going to tear that place up.
Yeah, and it's, you know, St. Andrews is, it's a golf course. Hell, I don't know. You know, tell me, what did you think of St. Andrews? You probably wouldn't have liked it the first time around and then grew to like it.
Well, you know, one of the things, there's a lot of blind shots at St. Andrews, especially off the tee. Yeah. You know, just hit it over there. And, you know, Americans don't like blind shots. they have a hard time not you can't commit to something you can't see. And, you know, I guess Hogan said, I can't hit a blind shot because I can't hit something I can't see. Well, we've kind of all lived by that. And so I never was a huge fan of St. Andrews. I appreciated and respected the history that was there. But I don't know. It wasn't my favorite place. Muirfield's my favorite golf course over there.
So. Yeah, Muirfield's a fantastic venue. That's arguably the greatest links as a pure links. But Yeah, with St. Andrews, they used to have an event called the Dunnell Cup, which was a team event. New Zealand doesn't have a lot of, you know, a lot of professionals, so I got to play it like 11 or 12 years. And so I got to, I mean, that's the first time I ever played with Curtis Strange. I was like 22, 23 years of age. Curtis was playing for America. So I have a little bit of affinity for the place, and I played a couple of open championships with there. So the Dunnell Cup was in October, and the open championship is always in July. So you would play that golf course, and it would never play the same. And that was the beauty of it. You could have a golf course that was, you know, close to 7,000 yards that could host an open. A kid could learn on it. You could play with your wife around there, and you could all play. Like, the beauty of that is everybody could play. Right. And I think, going back to your previous point, I think that's the problem now with the bifurcation talk, is that you could design, we're very close to it. You got to design one course over here for the best players in the world, and then another course. Even now, if I was to go and play now, I can't play there, of course. Got no chance. You know, so I got to play somewhere else.
Do you play much, Frank?
No, my back's still bad. I'm middle Mickey, man. I got a plate in this arm and a plate here, and I got a back that's about 100 years old. So, and I'm a rheumatoid arthritis sufferer. Yeah, so I'm bitter, twisted, and miserable. Apart from that, I'm happy. So,
hey, all those
well, people... I know about having metal in your body. I got two artificial hips and an artificial left knee, so I can't go through a metal detector without it.
Well, you couldn't before anyway.
All those people that said golf wasn't a sport, it'll wear you out over the course of years, right?
Yeah, will.
Yeah.
So, Frank, one of the things we like to ask players that come on here, what are two or three of the things that you've seen over time that if you could get amateurs to quit doing, what are some of the mistakes that you see that you saw in pro-ams? Or, again, we always like to kind of get some nuggets for our guys to, you know, to improve their games. Where would you go with that?
Number one, the focus should be on the swing and not the ball. And I don't mean as in trying to get a pretty swing. I mean, a lot of people just hit at the ball. So invariably when we're trying to do a little bit of a teach on the air, even though the time is very, very limited, like pitching, for example, the ball, because it lies so tight to the ground, you see the average amateur, they grab plenty of loft. And I'm not blaming that, because a lot of the players on TV, they see use a lot of loft, but they'll take a whopping great divot. They'll hit so steep on a pitch shot, and invariably it's half decent. They guts it or they hit it fat, right? So they got three shots and one in between. If you look at the best players in the world, they're very, very shallow. So the club just grazes the grass because they're not just hitting at the ball. And it's the same whether it's a drive or a long iron. The focus is almost like this ball's this, you know, the animal. Like, if I don't hit it, then it's not going to go anywhere. Well, you know, the last time I checked the golf swing, you know, you had a position to start off with, right? Then you had a backswing and you had a through swing. And the ball gets hit in the process. And if you watch all these young professionals or the old ones, they all did that. I was looking at a Hogan swing yesterday. And that's never changed. But if you look at the average amateur, everything is just focused like almost this ball. It isn't going to move unless they hit at it. And I really think a lot of the shots, if they're a little more through it, you know, in other words, if they actually made sure they completed their swing and the ball was hit in the process, I really think that would help. Alignment's another thing. You invariably see, you know, because everything's focused at the ball, I'm going to just pick a number. I don't know. It's probably wrong. But 90% of the average amateurs are shot at address, for example, because they're looking at the ball. So they're focused this way rather than looking at the target. So when they look up, they always look over their, if they're a right hand, they look over their left shoulder. And you know that, whereas all the best players in the world are normally, it's ball to target, right? Ball to target. And that's also why they swing through. And you see that in other sports too. I think when you see an amateur play, I don't know, hit a softball or a baseball, you know, they sort of hit at the ball rather than, you know, the professional, you know, they're almost throwing the bat out. They're making sure they complete the motion. And I think that would be the biggest thing. And that's not that hard, whichever way they swing it. I just think, you know, the ball gets hit in the process, but they're just fixated, like, I've got to hit the ball. No, it's
great stuff.
Yeah, that's what I would say, yeah.
Well, Frank, you've been great. We really appreciate you being on. I know your time is valuable, and you're always on the air, and it was nice of you to take the time out to do this for us today and all of our listeners. So thanks a bunch.
Well, thanks, Al, and you too, Chase. But, Al, yeah, I miss the days you and Freddie walking down the fairway. So the one thing we can take, and I know it makes it sound like old men, but memories. So the people that you – that you enjoy the journey with, you never forget. And Hal, you're always one of those. So cheers.
Well, you are too, Frank. I appreciate you saying that. I miss those days, and I bet you do too.
Yeah, I do. Yep.
We love to compete, you know, and you can't take that out of someone.
You're dead right. You're dead right, my friend.
Thanks, Frank.
Have a great day.
Cheers.
Be the right club today. Yes!